This episode of The Candid Frame is brought to you by the Charcoal Book Club. Their carefully curated selections reflects the best in contemporary photography and all for a reasonable price. And they are delivered directly to your doorstep each month. They offer free shipping to the US, Canada, and the UK. It's subsidized elsewhere. It's a wonderful way to begin or expand your photo library. Join the club at charcoalbookclub.com today. And remember to use the promo code THECANDIDFRAME. At checkout. At its best, photography can do more than document what's in front of it. It has the power to capture and express intimacy and vulnerability. We see glimpses of shared humanity and shared experiences of love, loss, joy, and grief. It's a special kind of photographer who can enter a stranger's life and create photographs that allow us to see ourselves in them. Barbara Peacock's project and subsequent book, American Bedroom, is just such a creation. She was almost halfway through the project when we last talked to her, and it took her longer than expected to finish. However, the result proves that it was time well spent. The environmental portraits show how Americans make their bedrooms not only a place to rest their heads, but also a reflection of how they are and what they aspire to be. This is Ibarian X, and welcome back to The Candid Frame. Well, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you again.
Thank you.
We first talked on the show 2019.
Yes.
And you were in the relatively early parts of the project we're going to talk about today. But it's been an amazing journey. It's been interesting to follow. Since I met you and had the chance to talk with you. Working on a project for that long is quite the commitment. But when you're working on something for a lot long, inevitably things change from the initial inception to the end. I'm curious to hear how the project changed for you over those years.
Sure. So the project ended up being 7 years, which I went back and listened to our interview recently because I thought I just wanted to see, you know, what we had talked about and all. And at one point in that interview, you asked me how long I thought it would take me to finish it, and I said a year and a half. I know. I had to really laugh when I heard that. So it ended up being 7 years. But there were a lot of reasons for that, and also 1 year of COVID, in which, you know, no one was going to let me in their bedroom. But you asked about what changed over the course of 7 years, and I think the first main thing that changed was the initial concept was I'm going to do a photographic project. So I'm thinking in terms of a visual image that I'm going to create, which I did. But what I wasn't really aware of the transformation of each individual person, what they had to say about their life. And that happened not in the very beginning. The first few of photographs that I took, I just did the photographs. I talked to the people a bit, but I didn't get a statement from them. And when I started to get statements was in, I think around 2000, it had to be 2017 because they were accompanied with the images for the Getty. I photographed a gentleman named Papere. He's an older gentleman. He's sitting on the edge of his bed with the cross and the Christian icons surrounded him. I think you might remember the image. Mm-hmm. And he said to me in conversation, every day I get up and I try to be quiet so I don't wake her. And then I remember she's no longer here. So when I heard that, I realized that there was another component to the photographs. And the other component was a personal statement from each person. And that, in my opinion, changed the project to a much deeper project than I had intended. And I was glad to have it revealed to me, because from then on, asked each person to make a personal statement that would tell me something about their lives or what they wanted to share about their lives. And I went back and asked the people that I had photographed previously to give me a statement. So every photograph comes accompanied by a personal statement. And I, at one point soon after that, I did not allow any of my photographs to be published without the accompanying statement, because I believe that the statement is as important as the photo, if not more important. And I truly believe that. So that was one thing that changed from my initial concept of the project, which enriched it. The second thing that happened further on was as I was meeting people and talking to people and experiencing some of their life and spending time with them, I began to realize that in this project, I was just, and I don't say this to be humble, but I was a conduit for all of these people to tell their American story. And I believe that these people that I met were sort of put into my path, and people that I found or found me, etc. So that was another big change, the way I viewed the project.
So what would you say is kind of the through line? Because you have a variety of different people, different situations, class, different races, ethnicities that are part of it. But you said at first that you saw it primarily as a visual project, but it became something else, and people are talking about their lives. But going a little sort of deeper beyond simply exploring people's lives, what do you think is sort of serves as the connective tissue for everything?
What I think has happened in these stories is that, for instance, Pepere, he's speaking for a collective people, a body of people that are widows or widowers or people who have lost a loved one, even a pet. So his statement is about loss and the loneliness, and so that is for the collective human experience that we all go through when we lose. And I experienced exactly what he was saying a year later when my dog died. Because every morning when I would get up, I would pour the coffee carefully so I didn't cling the cups. Because if I cling the cups, he jumped up and would want to go out right away. So I wanted to have a few sips of coffee before he woke. So I understood that on a different level. But when a woman says that living is not worth living if you can't be with the ones you love because her children have been taken away from her, there's many women or men who have experienced their children being taken away from them and living that life. And so she's speaking for that collective group of people that are experiencing that, or someone that is facing death, as in Mark, the gentleman who's on dialysis, and his statement is about not wanting to leave this world because he doesn't want to leave his family. And I think that, you know, that's really what we don't want to leave. You know, we don't want to leave this world, but it's heartbreaking to think that we have to leave our family. We won't see our children marry or have children or see our grandchildren. It's just, it's all these statements about life that summons others that are experiencing the same thing. So I think these different stories are telling a broader story of what we're all living through. Some of us are living through some of these stories, others are living through other stories, and it's speaking for a collective living situation in this time in America.
It's interesting because I see the bedroom as a space where most of us can choose to be our genuine selves more often than not. And that it's something that isn't often shared. I was just watching a film by Greta Gerwig. I think it's Frances Ha. And in an interview, she was talking about the experience of, there's a scene where she's moved into a new apartment and a friend comes over and says, oh, let me show you my room. And she made the point that that thing as a child is something you always do when you have a friend over, or come over and see my room. But then in your 20s, it's sort of that childhood time is sort of extended, especially if you're living in New York because you're sharing an apartment with several people. And that's sort of like,
right,
the kind of the last time you can say, hey, come to see my room.
Most of the time it's like, please do not come see my room. It's not ready. It's not clean.
Yeah, but it's as if that room is saying so much about who they are, and it's fascinating taking a look at your photographs, because the rooms are so distinctive. It's not like some idealized space that you see in some sort of furniture catalog. I mean, these spaces are lived in. Some people are heavily decorated, some places are pristine, some are in the midst of a sense of chaos, but they all reflect the people that are in that space. And I think that it's looking at the work, it's lovely to be reminded that that's what that space means. It's kind of a very a personal sort of holy place. Regardless of how you see God or religion or anything like that. And then when someone chooses to open that space up to someone else, and in your case, kind of photographer, it is a very special kind of invitation.
It sure is. I mean, it's not for everyone. So I didn't need everyone to open their bedroom to me. I'm not going to say it was always easy. Traveling around the country, it was important that I got to every state, which took the 7 years. I had to earn all the money to travel. So I wasn't using family money. I wasn't, I had to write grants. I had to sell prints. I had to accumulate the funds to travel. And traveling is not, it's expensive because you've got to fly somewhere, you got to rent a car, you've got to, food, lodging, and gas, and all that. And I usually traveled with someone for safety reasons, for my family back home to know that I would be safe. It's not great traveling by yourself. I did a couple of trips by myself, some local trips, and one to Texas and Louisiana. But in general, I always had someone with me, or in some cases, two people. It took a long time to get everywhere, and sometimes I would get somewhere, and the best scenario for me always was if I had done my research before I left. Let's say I'm going to do, in this case, the Midwest. The Midwest was a 3-week trip. It was the biggest trip of all. And you can see in the book, I have the book here, by the way, I have a copy. This was given to me in Paris. It was the first time I saw the book.
Oh, wow, lovely.
I know. It was supposed to come to me before I left, but it didn't. So in the beginning, as you see the map. So in the middle is the trip to the Midwest. So I would do my research, and I would reach out on Facebook, Instagram, and do some Craigslist ads to major cities and say, what the project was. I would post links to articles, the Guardian article, or, the New York Times, or, prestigious articles that people would realize I wasn't a kook, some crazy person that wanted to get in your bedroom. And by that time, people could go on to Instagram, they could go on, and they could see the legitimacy of the project by that time, and reach out to me and say they would like to do the project. So it's really a mixture of people who were open to opening their doors to me. A lot of people ask me, who and why people would open their doors to me. And I think there's a lot of different reasons, but I think one of the main reasons is that people want to be seen and heard. Mm-hmm. Some people who are under the radar, unseen, or people that have a voice or people that have a story. I used to say often, I'd love to find out about your story, not so much about the photograph in the room, but I'd like to talk to you about your story. What story do you have to tell? And people would really respond to that and say, well, I do have a very interesting story to tell. And somehow in all that, they were agreeable to have their photograph taken, and they could go on to Instagram and they could see the articles that had been written, and they could see the, like I said, the legitimacy of the project. So I think that comforted them a bit. And they would feel as if they were in a project, in an art project, or something that might be on the walls of a gallery or a museum or in a book, and that interested them. Also, a lot of people wanted to be incredibly honest, like bare bones honest, just because that's who they are. The couple that I photographed in New Mexico, the woman with the long, long gray hair, and they're embracing. Mm-hmm. They're farmers. They had their own property. They brought their children up there. And I asked them, what do you sleep in? And they said, we sleep in the nude. And without any more question, anything, they just took off their clothes and embraced. They wanted to show in the most truthful manner who they are. And it's just incredible to me. Incredible to me. I never asked anyone to take their clothes off in all of the photographs that I did in 7 years. I never asked anyone to take their clothes off. I think there was a couple of instances where we were doing some photography with the clothes on, and maybe we said, hey, let's try some nudes, and we did it, and it was fun, and, you know, that kind of thing. But now people decided what they wanted to do. We talked a little bit about it always first, like, what would you like to be doing in the bedroom? You know, someone be an avid reader. Well, I read every night, you know, so let's try to do something that's interesting about that. Or my husband and I embrace while we watch TV. So, you know, we would do that, that kind of thing, you know, just sort of very organic. Obviously they were semi-staged, if you will. It's not like I walked into the bedroom and found it as is and just photographed the person sitting there. We talked a little bit about it. My reference was a lot to paintings. So I had a lot of paintings on my phone. So let's say I was going to photograph a couple, I would research some paintings, contemporary paintings and classical paintings, and I would bring them to maybe 10 paintings, and I would show them to my couple and say, you know, if they didn't know what to do, a lot of people are like, well, Barb, you tell me what to do. And I'm like, well, this is really your story. What are you comfortable with? And if they didn't know anything, I would say, well, let's look at these paintings. And they would look at the paintings and they would say, ooh, I really like this one. Let's do that. So I'm like, okay. And we would start there. So there's always a starting point for these things. And as people warm up and they're more comfortable, we continue, and I'll take images from different angles to be sure I get the image that I'm happy with and the image that tells the story to the best of the ability of the room and the people.
Yeah. I think you're so on point with when you make the statement that these people wanted to be heard and seen. There's an incredible amount of validation that comes from that. And I think that most people are missing that from their lives, especially now when everyone is, you know, using social media to put out an idealized version of themselves, where genuineness is not something that's celebrated. It's a faux genuineness, right? But it's not very real. Mm-hmm. And so people mm-hmm. are very hungry to sort of put the mask down and open up, even to a perfect stranger. You know, I know, speaking for myself, there's some people I'm more quick to open up to who I know I don't have a sort of day-to-day connection with, right? But when I have the opportunity, I'll be more than glad to share stuff that, you know, I'm kind of reticent, not reticent, but hesitant to to share mm-hmm. with someone who I'm close to on a day-to-day. And I think that you coming in with a camera gives them license to be able to do that. And I think that really, I think for me, that ultimately is what the book is about for me, is that need to be, to receive some sort of affirmation for just being, for just existing, mm. that regardless of where they are in terms of age or with their finances or anything like that, it's like, I have a right to be here. I have a right to exist. Mm-hmm. And I just want someone to recognize that. So that's why I think
every
that the
story
project is so beautiful.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And every story is important. Everyone's story.
I think that
validation, as you say, is part of that, is that I walk into someone who's probably never been photographed since their high school senior portrait.
Hmm.
And never been interviewed before, never had the light shine on them. And now someone from, you know, long distance away is here and they're interested in me and they want to talk to me and they want to take my photograph.
Yeah, you're working.
It's
much,
a very
much
human level. It's just human to human conversation and collaboration. That's it.
Yeah, you're working very much in the spirit of one of my heroes, Studs Terkel, who did very much the very same thing with a camera, but with a microphone and a recorder, going to people, ordinary people, asking them about their lives and them opening up and telling their stories, which is, you know, in both his case and your case, a very American one. Tell me about how that distinction, the Americanness of it, sort of revealed itself to you as you worked on the project over 7 years.
Yes. I had never traveled across the country before. You know, in a vehicle like everyone gets to do in their late teens or early 20s. I had never done it. And so it was wonderful to see all the different areas of the country. And one of the first areas that I sort of penetrated was the South. I went there 3 times in the very beginning, from 2016 through 2019. I went 3 different times and kind of learned a little bit about how the people respond to each other and to strangers. And, you know, it is true, Southern hospitality. It is true. And we had a flat tire at one point, and neither of us really actually knew how to do it properly. And I was worried, and my friend was like, and I'm like, we have nothing to worry about, because all we have to do is stand here for a minute or two and everyone's going to come. And this is absolutely true. We were at a gas station, and within 5 minutes, we had one guy who was working on our car. Another guy pulled up in a truck and said, hey, do you need any tools, dude? And they were like doing a thing together. And another guy came, and there was like 5 people trying to help us. And just going to like a little store and stopping in and people asking us and them giving us food, like not charging us, just like, here on the house, we'd love to, you know, you travelers, we're going to trade stories and we're going to tell you about our life and have all this fried food on the house. just the hospitality and the people. So in part of the answer to your question, it was seeing the different pockets of the states and how open people were. But what I have to tell you is, what I think is, the more genuine you are as a person when you're traveling, just low key, just who you are, no airs. I want to say that every state I went to and the people I met were all wonderful and open. And the only thing that I saw that was a little dicey would be some intense conservatism here and there. But I was very careful never to enter into any conversation ever about politics or ideologies or religion. That was kind of my mantra and my awareness that that was never going to go anywhere good.
How do you feel like you changed over the span of the project?
Yeah, so that's a good question. I think it was just, I just became more and more in love with people in general. Just the experience of meeting a perfect stranger and having a conversation. And what I say in my statement at the end of the book was, a couple things, and you just mentioned this a few minutes ago. You said that the people that you see every day, you might not talk about the big things, but people that you don't see very often, you might talk about the bigger things, maybe philosophy, maybe ideologies, maybe these things. And that actually would happen to me with these people because I'm coming into their life, their living room, their kitchen first, and then their bedroom ultimately. And what are we going to talk about? No, we didn't talk about religion necessarily. We didn't talk about, ideologies or religion. We talked about big things, the big things in life. My husband passed away. I've been alone for 10 years. Or, I've lost my children. Or I've never married and I've been alone. Or, I was injured in the war, and they want to tell me about the war, like big things. And I was there to listen. So I found that fascinating. And I think I became a better listener. You said, what has changed? So I think I became a better listener and realizing that, as I said before, I was a conduit for these stories. I was let in. That was a privilege, a huge privilege. And I didn't take it lightly anytime anybody opened their door. And also anytime anyone said they would like to be photographed, I always did it, whether I thought, oh, that's too far to travel, or I already have a lot of photos like that, or if for some reason I thought it wasn't going to be a great photograph or something, I always did it anyway. Because you never know how the photograph will turn out. And here's a case in point. In Hawaii, I had a lot of people that answered me because apparently in Hawaii they really like Craigslist. And I had a lot of people that answered me, and a lot of very interesting people, including the gentleman who ends the book who sleeps in the grass, who's been sleeping in the grass for 7 years. But this woman reached out to me, and she had 2 children, and I was like, yeah, all right, yeah, I'll come photograph that. She didn't have like some kind of crazy interesting life, a mom with 2 kids. I'm like, okay. And I went and I photographed her. And to be honest with you, it seemed a little bit like a lifestyle shoot that I have done in my commercial career. And we're using beautiful light, and I'm photographing her and her children. And it was lovely and beautiful. And she was a wonderful, charming woman. But when I got her statement, it blew me away. It was one of the most beautiful statements I've ever heard about being a mother and raising children. So she was just bumped to the top because everyone that read her statement about rearing children was just so touched. So sometimes it wasn't as much about the photograph as it was about what the person had to say about life and being a mother and that sort of thing. But I think, again, in answer to your question, I think I did become a better listener, and I did realize that it was my project, and it was my vision, but it really just was not all about me. It was bigger than me. And that's how I felt about it after I got going in the project after about 2 or 3 years.
During 2020, during COVID, you were unable to make the photographs. But what the unintended break of that year? How do you feel it's helped to shape the project?
Well, I kind of took the time to hone down and work on a lot of the files and the trips that I had made and organize and all that kind of thing. And then I also helped my husband a bit with his restaurant. I did take one trip to Kansas City because there was a woman there who was 97 years old, who there's a photographer that I became friends with on Facebook, and he would always photograph his mom. And she was just this beautiful woman, and she's 97 years old. So I think about 6 months, maybe into COVID, maybe 5 months, I asked if their family would allow me to photograph her, and they said yes. So I just double masked and took chances, and I went and photographed her. And then I photographed some other people in Kansas City at the time. I think people were a bit closed down, obviously, and not as willing. And I didn't ask people except for that one woman and a handful of other people I was traveling. But I think when COVID was lifting a little bit, I think people were, as you know, very energized to communicate again. Mm-hmm. So I think at the end of COVID, I think it was sort of a rebirth of interest in and people wanting to respond to, again, my project, but many other projects as well. And just people in general wanting to be in the world, you know, out in the world.
One of the images that you included in the book that I loved that you included was of your own bureau or armoire.
Oh.
I have all
this
stuff.
At the very end. Okay, so that photograph. So I kept these journals for each trip. I kept journals. I wrote all the details down because there were a lot of details about where I was traveling and who I was going to be meeting. And it was a lot of logistics. And, you know, if I wasn't organized, it could get very complicated. So I had these journals, and I also did drawings and sketches in them and all my little, you know, blah, blah, blah. So I had all these stacks of journals that were all the notes for the 7 years of my journeys across the country. And also on my phone, because we're photographers, and what do? We take pictures. Now, I know if you're anything like me, and I know plenty of photographers who can barely drive down the street without taking a photograph. That's just what we do. And so when I'm traveling in the South, I'm in the Midwest, I'm seeing all these things, and I'm, you know, picture, picture, picture. I'm taking pictures constantly. So there's 100,000 images on my iPhone from this 7 years of traveling. What is that? That's America. I mean, we're talking, that's showing the culture of this country. And I actually showed some of the pictures to the gentleman in Paris, and he's like, this is another book, Barb. You've got to do this. This is amazing. But anyway, so long story short, I wanted to somehow in the book put the journals and the photographs together somehow. And we talked a lot about it. I was really going to have a fold out that was going to show all the photos. But my publisher and the designer showed me a photograph of this woman's studio that she had a photograph of, and it was, you know, her table and then some things on the wall, this, that, and the other. And they said, do you have like an area that you could lay out your journals and maybe put some photos out? And I said, at first, no, I don't. And then I'm like, oh, yes, I do. I have this cabin that has, it's like an area where I draw and paint, et cetera. So that's where I set it up. So I took all the journals and I went through all my photos, and I had printed out photos with a little bit of white space on the bottom. So it kind of looks like a Polaroid, and I could write like, you know, where I was or that kind of thing. And I mean, I met Robert Plant. There's a picture of me and Robert Plant in the book, in a bookstore in Nashville. And so I just, it's kind of like a little bit of my life. There's odes to like my mom is there, my kids are there, my friends are there, my husband's there, different things, and then pictures from my travels. So it was a shot overhead with some natural light, and yeah, it was fun. I thought it was a little bit of a surprise for the viewer of the book.
How How has your own personal space evolved, changed?
In my actual bedroom?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little bit of a neatnik, and I like a comfortable space, clean white comforter, throw pillows. I always make my bed, some art on the walls, nothing too much, simple, nice rug, books. I mean, originally that was the whole thing when I woke up and I looked at what's on your side table and I asked myself all those questions about what do we have, you know, what does it say about our lives,
mm-hmm.
in an anthropological way. But there's nothing too fancy about my bedroom, but it's usually picked up and somewhat neat, except for some piles of clothes maybe here or there.
Because it's always, it fascinates me how each of us sort of claims our space. I have friends who, you go into their house or go into their rooms and you know exactly who they are. Right? I mean, every inch of the space is reflective of some aspect of their personality. And it's not anything that's derived from a catalog, right?
Mm-hmm.
They put together things that you think would never fit. And somehow, through the way that they see themselves and they see their space and they see the world, everything seems like it was meant to be together. And I am not one of those people. I struggle. I'm sure that people could come in here and just see all the books on the shelf and that tells them mm-hmm. as much as they need to know about me, I guess. But it's always interesting to see how and why people choose to decorate, infuse their space in whatever way they kind of see fit. You know, that in some way that it serves a need.
Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely.
It goes beyond.
I was going to say, even the houseless folks in the book have specifics in their space to comfort them. The China in Manhattan has her books and her pillows and I think some little stuffed animal and, you know, she's on the streets, but she has those things.
Yeah,
and the gentleman in the grass also, he had all his daily needs there around him on his white sheet. He says he can only be in a white sheet because his body is so pure from the rain. He's always outside.
So putting together the edit for the book, what was that like for you?
That was, So I had in the past understood that a great way to edit is with a group of people, maybe a handful of people that you respect and trust, and they call it choral editing. I learned that from Ernesto Bazan. That's how he edits his books, with a group of people. And so that's what I decided to do, call on the people that I knew would give me the right answers, not any kind of answer I wanted to hear, that they were going to be true to what they thought were the best images. So here's how we did it. There's five sections to the United States: the Northeast, the South, the Midwest, the Northwest, and the Southwest. And how I broke down the book was there would be 18 photographs from each section. So that's when you go through the sections and there's a color and it has a title.
Mm-hmm.
The images are basically from those sections. So we needed to pick 18 images from each section. How are we going to do that? So what I did was I did the initial edit down to about 35 images for each section. So right off the bat, some images were not going to be in the book. So I made all the choices that I could reasonably make, like you say, ethnicity and different types of couples and different types of families, et cetera, age, all the different ages, et cetera. So I tried to pick the broadest spectrum of people in that area that I could. So then I had to make a PDF that had the image and the statement because, as I had said before, the statement is equally as important. So I made these PDFs with the 35 images and sent them to my 7 people, including my son, Landon, who has been with me on this project. And you might see a thank you to him in the back of the book. And he's the toughest editor I know. He really is. And he has we have an extremely similar aesthetic. So he headed up, and I also had Sarah Lean. I don't know if you know Sarah Lean. She's, photo editor for National Geographic, who lives up here in Maine. And so she was on the team, and then a handful of others that had traveled with me and knew some of these people. So I would send that off, and what they were to do was pick 20 images. 20 because I needed to have a little bit of flux in case we needed an older person or a younger person or, you know, a different ethnicity. So I had 20 of each section. So I did that for each section. And then we had to make the hard decision once we looked at everything. So there were 20 images from each of the 5 sections. And then we had to whittle take out 2. But we couldn't really do that until we could see what else we had and what might be missing or what we had too much of. You know, so that's how we did it. And it was very difficult, and people were having a very hard time to get to their 20, and then we had to take 2 more out. And so some great images are not in the book, and some wonderful people are not in the book, just because I would often cancel myself out if I had, you know, too many of a certain age or too many of the certain type of couple or... Mm-hmm.
Some of those decisions are almost impossible to make.
Almost impossible.
What helped make you make this choice? Was it a deadline? Those usually are
it was, the best ways it, to... It actually was a deadline because once I signed a contract with K.R. Verlag, it was kind of game on, because if we wanted to get the book printed in, I believe it was printed in September and then out for this year, then there were deadlines. So, you know, you keep backing up. And I think the deadline, I'm trying to remember what the deadline was. So it was printed in September, August. I believe it was sort of the end of maybe July. Or the beginning of August, that I had to have all the files and to them. So, yeah. So at first it was like, oh, here's the 35 images. You guys need to pick 20. You have a week. And then by the 5th one, it's like, I need them tomorrow. It's like things sped up a little bit.
How'd you come to work with this particular publisher, and why did you feel like they were a good fit for what you were doing?
Well, I looked around and I saw, you know, obviously there were many, many choices, and some people were interested in me and others were not interested in me. So there's that. I really loved their design aesthetic. I absolutely loved the books I'd seen. And I ordered some and I'd seen some. And I knew that I've done the photography. I've interviewed the people. I have the story. I'm not a designer, and I knew that I wanted it a clean design, and I knew I needed input from someone who was a good designer to sort of give me what I was looking for, which was a contemporary look, but not trying too hard, clean, good sense of color. And I saw that in K.R. Verlag's books. And I was very excited to work with their designer. And also the fact that it would be printed in Germany on a Heidelberg press. and that I could be at the printing, and that meant that was important to me as well. And it was all hands-on, everybody in the office, you know everyone, it's not like you're a number. It's very personal. And so that's how I ended up going with K.R. Verloc.
I find myself drawn to photographs that examine family and community. It may be because I'm getting older and have become more sentimental, but something about that kind of work inspires and moves me. They remind me that the most important photographs I will ever make will be those that reflect my own life, my family, and my friends. Many photographers turn their lenses inward and create bodies of work that are as much poetry as they are photography. The Charcoal Book Club provides a showcase for just such work. Titles like I Can't Stand to See Your Cry by Raheem Fortune and What Should I Be by Jacqueline Silderbrush are lovely, moving, genuine and honest books, qualities that are so often missing from our regular discourse. These and other reasons are why I'm such a fan of the Charcoal Book Club and why I believe you should be too. With your membership, you receive a quality monograph each month. The books reflect the diversity of genres, photographers, and styles that you will enjoy even if they are not a genre of photography that you practice yourself. And if you don't like that month's release, you can choose an alternate book of equal value in their catalog. They offer free shipping to the US, Canada, and the UK. It's subsidized elsewhere. Sign up today and use the promo code TheCandidFrame at checkout to enjoy 10% off your first membership payment. Having a good designer on a project brings in a really distinctive vision, a new vision to the work that you're doing. What did you learn about the work as a result of working with the designer for the book?
I went into the design meeting knowing that I wanted the image on the right and the statement on the left. Like, I knew that. And I knew I wanted the image to be as big as possible. So in this book, for instance, so the image that you're seeing here, that's bigger than like the normal dimensions. And I had to pay extra for that. So I was like, I want the image to be as big as possible, because on my first book, I had wished that the image was a little bit bigger. Mm. So we learn these things. But how did the images relate to the design? I think the flow of the introduction, the pages, I wanted like a nice introduction, a nice slow introduction, not like, you know, you open up the book and bam. And also, I don't have a long written introduction in the front. It's just that short Larry Fink statement, which I really like. I think just simplicity in a way. It was just like, here's the photos. Let the photos speak for themselves. But let me listen to this designer who, that's their profession. That's their job. And that's what they know how to do. And they would steer me in certain directions as far as fonts go and as far as the layout went and the color. I really wanted these colors in between the chapters. And I think overall the design of it is, I feel as if it's a fairly simple design, but clean and contemporary, which is what I was looking for. And I think that the images speak for themselves, because they're just the image and the statement. I don't know if that answers your question.
No, it does. It does. You know, one of the things about, you know, putting it in a book is like, you know, the publisher is going to have their own means for marketing the book, but also a good amount of it falls on the photographer themselves, especially in this age. What can you share? What how and what you're doing in order to get the word out on the book? Because I think everyone dreams of putting together a book, but they kind of stop at holding it in their hands. And it's like, yeah, you got a lot of books to move at this point. So
yeah. I'm in process of that, and I'll have more answers for you. I'm talking to some press people that I'm trying to hire. So that's happening, and I know that's the first step. I need to do some book signings. I have. I was given X amount of books, and I pre-sold what I could. I still have books to sell. So, I do need to do that. I end up in debt over this whole thing. So, between the traveling and the cost of the book, et cetera, I do need to sell these books to pay back some debt that I have accrued. In the end, I didn't use any credit cards for the whole time. I just, I used real money. I would raise money, or I would get a grant, or I would sell prints, and then I would go and do my trip. But in the end, I got to get this thing done. I just got a couple of credit cards and kind of maxed them out. So I have those, that's fun. And then, some debt. I mean, let's be honest here. Honestly, I sold my life insurance. I sold my little Volkswagen. I sold some stocks I had. I used some inheritance money from my mom. I lent my husband some money when he started his restaurant. I got that back. So, it's a very kind of costly enterprise to create this particular body of work, and to and the printing of the book was very expensive. So I need to get proactive, and I'm just back now, and I just have behind me, you can see there's 10 books there. I don't know if you can see, but I have just a stack of 10 books. Those are like author's books is what I'm guessing. They sent me 10 books, and then I'll be getting my 400 books next week. And then I'll be sending them out, and then getting some press and doing local things and et cetera. But yes, I do need to, get more interviews and get more press and more book signing. So that's kind of in the works.
So it's interesting that all the things that you had to do in order to make this project to get through this whole project, to finally see it in the book, all the financial, sacrifices and compromises you had to make are the very excuses that most people would choose to not do the project or to stop. Why was it so important to you to do this thing, despite the obvious financial challenges it offered you?
Yeah, exactly. Well, coming from a certain family where adult child not finishing things, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. It was important to me to take charge of this concept that I had and finish it. Because when I was younger, I didn't finish things. And so it took me a long time to do the project Hometown, and that had all its reasons. And we talked about that in our last podcast. But it was extremely important to me to start something and finish it. And to be honest with you, I really wanted to do the project. I was definitely attached to it emotionally and in its very concept as an artist is something that I had created, and I wanted to see it through and finish it. And I felt that I needed to set out and do what I said I was going to do, which was get to every one of the 50 states. Which I did. I had to beg my husband to take me to Hawaii for a vacation, which he acquiesced It took me to. And I won a grant and saved that money for Alaska because I knew that would be expensive. And then my last small trip was my middle son went with me. We went to Pennsylvania and Maryland and Delaware and Connecticut and Rhode Island, all these little states that I hadn't gone to. And that finished it. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, I just really felt as if I had started this thing. There was momentum. And I was dedicated to it as a project, and I just needed to finish it, no matter what. No matter what got in my way, I had to finish it.
And to my thinking, I think one of the things that it provided you, it's probably helped sustain the momentum or the experiences that you're having. You know, those are irreplaceable. You know, we think of money either in terms of security or what we can buy, right? Mm. And neither really quantifies into experiences, right? And I've kind of sort of have learned that my concerns with money, I've sort of weaned myself away from buying stuff. You know, I really have to justify even putting out $20 for something.
Well, good for you.
Because I've wasted so much money on stuff that I didn't need. But then
absolutely.
The other part of me,
and we have house full of it.
Yeah. And then, but the other part of me is this idea of security, you know? But then the idea of thinking too much in terms of that, you think too much about saving stuff that you're not really using it to have a life either. So it's like trying to find that sort of that sweet, you know, medium. And I think this project, I understand why you did the project, despite the financial challenges it resulted in. It's like, man, what a life you were living during those 7 years, meeting all these people, traveling across the country. You know,
yeah, pretty incredible. Yeah,
I mean, that's priceless.
I mean, it was nice too because. So I mentioned that my husband took me to Hawaii and people were very open there. And when we got there, my husband had never gone on any trip with me because first of all, he has a restaurant. And second of all, I am better not to be with, say, family members, maybe just on my own with some people who are like photographers. It just works better that way. You know, you can say really focused. If you're with family, you can get defocused. So it's much better for me to travel with sort of like-minded folks. But he took me to Hawaii, and the first shoot that we had was this lovely woman and her daughter, who is native Hawaiian, 100%. And they lived down this road. They had to meet us somewhere so we could find where they lived, and we got there. And it was the first time that my husband had seen what I've been doing for the last 7 years. And it was a beautiful experience because it was her and her daughter. She was a single mom, very devoted. She's in the book. Beautiful light, like gorgeous light. And I do the shoot. And afterwards, they had prepared us a meal. They had cooked a meal for us. And with her daughter together, they made this meal and they served us and they had fresh bread. And then the young daughter, she made the dessert and she made whipped cream and she brought it to the table. So we're having this full experience. And it doesn't happen every time. Sometimes I do a photo shoot and I meet the people and they got to go on and, you know, tend their garden. They've got things to do. They don't have time to sit and chat. But in this case, it was, and it was lovely. As you said, these experiences that, you know, that are so enriching and moving, that they would go out of their way to do all this and have this time together and experience it. And sometimes we stay in touch. I stay in touch with these people. But it was nice for my husband to see that, you know, what I had been doing all these 7 years. And of course, there's been amazing, kooky, crazy situations that I could tell you about. And one particular funny scene in South Dakota. So I get to South Dakota and I have my two, this is the Midwest trip I did with two friends, two photographers from Portland, Oregon, who I'm very close to. And they had just gotten married and they came with me on the trip. And it was just Great. They're very young. They have a lot of energy. One is a researcher. Actually, she's not a photographer. She's a researcher. She's getting her doctorate in research and all that. She's a librarian, a digital librarian. And my other friend is a photographer and a filmmaker. And she did all the driving. I could do all my research and everything. But we got to South Dakota, and we stayed in this little cabin on a farmer's cabin. It was an Airbnb. And so it was really great. We're on this farm, and I was supposed to photograph this woman, and she ended up saying, no, this happens. So now I have no one to photograph. I'm in South Dakota. I'm spending all this money. I just sold my life insurance to get on this trip, and I've got a credit card. I can have up to like $10,000 for this trip, right? I got to photograph someone in South Dakota, or I'm going to like blow this whole thing, right? So you know, my two young friends are like, let's go. So what do? Okay, you go to gas stations. You go to bars, you go to local hardware stores or hair salons where everybody knows everybody. So they're young, they drink, we go to a bar, we meet a bunch of people. The bartender says, well, I'll do it, but I'm not free till tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. I'm like, okay, we're there, 6 a.m. She has 1 hour before she goes to her second job. Okay, we got one person. So then she says, well, go down to, downtown, and you'll meet a bunch of people. We said, well, where's downtown? They said, 2 gas stations at a cross section. So it's just like what you can imagine in the Midwest, right? It's just 2 gas stations. So we go to one, we sit there, nothing's happening. We go to the other one, we get there. I meet this dude, I talk to him for a while. He's really cool, he's kind of interested. Maybe he'll do it, maybe he won't. I go inside, I grab a few things, I'm at the cash register, and I say, this woman says to me, can I get you anything else? I look at my watch and I go, yeah, I need to photograph someone tonight within the next 3 hours. Do you know anyone? She says, I'll do it. She says, I'll do it. And I said, all right, sure. She goes, but like, I'm here till 9. I'm like, well, the light's gone by then. She goes, I'll get my grandmother to come take my place. So her grandmother is working in the other part of the gas station in the casino. Mm. So in her her Fargo-esque, she calls her grandmother over. Her little grandmother comes over, takes her place. We drive to her place, which is like 1 mile from there. She's in a single wide. She's got all these cats. She goes in. We're in her room. She's this great kid. She's like 18 years old, 19 years old. She's got this super huge unicorn, and there's clothes everywhere, just clothes everywhere. And I got a little bit of light coming in, and I start to photograph her. I'm like, I got to get my tripod. I go out to the car, come back with my tripod, and she's talking to her grandmother on the phone, and she's like, the grandmother's like, I don't know how to ring these people up. I got a line of people here, and I don't know what button to push. And she's like, push this button, do this. And she goes, FaceTime me. So now they're FaceTiming each other in this like unbelievable, like, South Dakota drawl, back and forth. She's talking to her grandmother. She's like, I gotta go. It's the craziest scene you've ever seen.
Oh, that's
and then
awesome.
She lies down and looks at me. It was just so great. It was funny.
That's great. That's a wonderful
stuff like
story.
That all over.
Well, my last question that I ask each guest is I ask them to recommend another photographer for our listeners to discover and explore. And it can be anyone, someone you've long admired or someone you've recently discovered. So who would that be and why?
Yeah. So, August. Well, so I really love, and I hope I say your name right. Maybe you can correct me. Alessandra Sagoniti?
Yeah.
Dude, is that proper? Is that how you say your name?
I know who you're talking about, so.
Yeah. So, yeah. I am incredibly moved by this work. It is really deeply emotional when I see the work. It's beautifully composed, and it's very, she's embedded. It's a deeply personal project, and she's embedded with these people. And I'm just, like I said, very moved by it. And they always say, if you're going to do a project or whatnot, you should do what makes your heart skip a beat. And this work makes my heart skip a beat. And so for my next project, I definitely want to do something along the lines of something, you know, very intimate. And I said that to someone recently and they said, what's more intimate than bedrooms, Barb? And I'm like, no, but intimate on in a different level in that you are embedded or you are just really with maybe a family or four generations of a family or whatnot or something. So anyway, this is a very inspirational work to me.
Well, thank you for that. And thank you again for sitting down with me. It was as joyful as ever to speak with you.
You too. Thank you so much.
Thanks to the many of you who have supported The Candid Frame over these many years. I spent some time with some of you recently over a Zoom meetup, and I've decided to return to these informal periodic meetings to help me to get to know you and you me. So along with supporting the show, you can get to know many other people who believe in our mission to create a supportive and safe community. You can become a part of it by becoming a Patreon supporter today. You can contribute $5, $10, $20 or more a month by visiting patreon.com/thecandidframe. And again, it's patreon.com/thecandidframe. Thanks. Thanks to Barbara for joining us. Learn more about Barbara and her project by visiting AmericanBedroomSeries.com. And if you're a fan of our work, you can write reviews on whatever service you use to listen to podcasts and share a favorite episode on social networks, be it X, formerly Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. And remember to use the hashtag #TheCandidFrame. You can support us financially via Patreon. But if you only want to make a one-time donation to the show, you can now do so through Buy Me a Coffee by visiting buymeacoffee.com/TheCandidFrame. Thanks to Nehemiah Montgomery and Remus for their recent contributions. And we've relaunched our newsletter, and if you want to receive updates on everything related to TCF, including book recommendations and other announcements, sign up by visiting our website or click on the link in the show notes. And if you can't find every show episode on whatever service you use to listen to podcasts, download the Candid Frame app, available for Apple iOS and Android. And because of your generosity, it's free to download and use. No additional purchases are required. The Candid Frame audio engineer is Martin Taylor, who you can find at theothermartintaylor.com. And the show's senior producer is Cynthia Parker. And this is Ibarian X, and this is The Candid Frame.